incredibly distinguished speakers, and if I were to try to give them a proper introduction, we wouldn't have enough time to hear them speak. So I'm going to speak just very briefly about each one before they speak. We're very, very pleased to have Richard Freeman back to speak to us. He's the Herbert Ashman Chair in Economics at Harvard, and he's currently serving as Faculty Director of the Labor and Work-Life Program at the Harvard Law School. He's also Director of Labor Studies Program at the NBER. I can't even begin to even list all the relevant words, but a couple that probably I should mention before Richard takes over. One is America Works, Critical Thoughts on the Exceptional U.S. Labor Market, which was published by Russell Sage in 2002, and Can Labor Standards Improve Under Globalization with Kimberly Ann Elliott for the Peterson Institute in 2003. You guys may remember a while ago he wrote an article, Are Our Wages Set in Beijing? And I'll be interested in hearing, that was in 1995, I'd be very interested in hearing his thoughts almost a decade and a half later. Thanks a lot for coming, Richard.
Okay, yes, thank you. Look at that, so he's here. Thanks. I'm glad to be here. You just forgot to mention that I used to beat Ed Lemer in basketball quite often.
That was the other way around.
Oh, memory is amazing. okay, so this is the title, and I will go back a bit into what I thought, not as far back as.
Am
I on the way too?
Hey, yes. You're fine.
Okay, get over up here. Let's see, okay. So this potential disaster.
This is way too hard for me.
Okay. We'll make it. We'll make it. Okay.
That's some room here.
Okay.
You moved a bottle of water
to. Okay. Okay. The bottle of water is over there. Okay, so is everybody happy?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So I will go back and forth to sort of before this, the collapse of the Wall Street, and then after. And the case, I'll even quote myself. Honestly, you'll see. This was my view before, and that puts a great stress on how we deal with the globalization. And from a labor economics perspective, I do labor things, the big factors were that we doubled the global workforce because India, China, and the ex-Soviet had been sort of outside the system. And it turns out we had roughly twice as many workers when they joined the economy. Another aspect, which is very critical to, I think, understanding the positives and negatives, is that higher education is, I'll give you some evidence in a minute, spreading immensely around the world. And we have, I'm sure this campus, my campus, the faculty is many immigrants, and student body, oodles of international students. And then we like to think of this as there's a race between some pressures for pay convergence, which would be the pay set in Beijing kind of thing, versus the fact that we've had good productivity advance, and we have some mechanisms for redistributing within our countries from the wealthy, the winners to the losers. And I was always uneasy that the capital markets were such a great thing, mostly because I was involved in the Korea when they got hit with the Asian crisis, and then later in Argentina, where you saw what in one day the collapse of the peso did to Argentina. And Argentina was considered this global poster child, poster economy for the Washington Consensus. And I should just say that probably the person who's the trade economist who's the most adamant about the good things of globalization and international trade has been Jagdish Bhagwati. And to his credit, he also is very suspicious of the capital markets. What I didn't realize was that the most dangerous capital market in the world was ours. And that's just totally new to me. I didn't know that. I've been generally positive towards the effects of this globalization on our living standards in our country and other advanced countries. Of course, it's going to be good for the poor countries. It has to be, barring utter disaster. And I put a great stress on our industry, that a greater increase of knowledge. It just has to shift out the production possibilities frontier. And somehow or other, there's lots of adjustments and transitions and problems, but that ultimately has to dominate. That's been my view. And so I said here, and I'll come back to this because this sounds a little science fiction-y, the possible singularity due to all the brains and computers working together. We just have more knowledge creation power than we ever had before. And if we obviously apply it to good things, I'll give you a couple of examples of what stuff. But this period is going to be 50 years before the convergence of wages and things go, China and India back to us. 50 years is obviously a vaguely made up number, sufficiently far in the future that no one will ever be able to, at least I won't be around when somebody says that's a wrong number. But it took about 50 years for Japan post-World War II to get to where they were, equivalent to the U.S. Taking Korea about 50 years to get more or less the same thing. And, China and India and other countries. And then the more controversial part that I always would phrase, here I haven't done a little rehistory. I would always phrase this very carefully, because if you said industrial policy, a lot of economists would just jump all over you and say you're not. I would always say, well, we're really talking about research and development policy, which then ultimately becomes industrial policy, and et cetera, et cetera. But I think it can be a little more straight on that. And then I have this great little thing. I didn't realize this whole session was about the apocalypse, because I would always be saying things that this was all subject to these four horsemen. Global pandemic. Well, we just had the Asians. We just had the Mexican swine flu problem, which turns out not to have been a great disaster at all. Global warming, which we continue to think, except for a few strange characters, is a problem. The terrorist stuff can clearly cause terrible things. And then I was thinking not of the current administration, but of the previous administration, political impact. Just not making rational decisions, and these things can screw things up all over the place. So this is all subject to the fact that we deal with these successfully. And then the surprise to me, and why the talk is posed to thing, I didn't realize there was a fifth horseman. I think if you go back to the Bible and all this stuff, there's only four. But maybe this is political insanity, but I don't think this was generated by the politicians per se. And I'm going to be a little sharp about this. I gather you've had a previous session about the meltdown and the financial thing, which I'm going to be given to talk so I can see what people said there. And I'll be very very sharp about this. I've been moved to think of the U.S. economy as having a crony capitalist financial elite that has enriched itself at the expense of everybody else. And I believe that, as we will see over the next few years, there'll be more and more arrests made for criminal behavior, and then we'll find out there's just a lot of decisions that were not quite criminal, but were absolutely amoral. If you look at this morning's Wall Street Journal, it is remarkable. Mr. Friedman, who was president, CEO, something, the New York Fed, but obviously had been very important, was also running Goldman Sachs, therefore was a partner, not running, but having a big deal. and was buying Goldman Sachs shares while he was doing the New York Fed, while he was making decisions. And the Wall Street Journal, to see them come out and say, this is not right, he should go, and that somebody else, they said, should also be going from the New York Fed. And the Wall Street Journal says, of course he wasn't there to enrich himself. He was making decisions, out of his wisdom for the financial market. I don't know why Goldman Sachs managed and Tim Geithner managed to place him there if it wasn't that he was going to do things for the financial elite. And I see just a pure, simple economics model says, hey, you put somebody in a great deal of power that represents a particular group, and you see their decisions seem to be enriching that group. In any case, we've now seen that this process has produced massive inequality, financial meltdown, and the global recession. Not been caused by the crooked banks in China, which I had originally, 2 years ago, I spoke in China. I said, oh, why don't you be like the American banks? Transparent enough, it shows to show what I know about this. I mean, so this is the fifth force. So I give you what I call the orthodoxy, which was before. You know who said government isn't the solution to our problems, it's the problem. And you probably know who said there's no such thing as society. And you don't know the gentleman raising his hand to no. But you do know the gentleman who gave the last statement. Those ideas, and he's referring to this whole set of stuff, have been tested and they have failed. They brought our economy to a halt, and now is the time to move forward, not back. And in case you don't recognize that gentleman, that's our president speaking. So we have for the first time really a post, how to phrase it right, Washington consensus view in Washington. So this is what I want to say. Should one think that the long-term effects of globalization are still positive, even after this? That's assuming we control the now the five apocalypses. The financial one, I think, is critical. And I think yes. And then we talked about how we control them. It just means we can't let markets be markets in the sense of somebody you may know in Boston, he's now your problem. It was let Manny be Manny. And Manny is just like one of the financial markets, has proven what he did prove in Boston, he's now proven in Los Angeles. That you let Manny be Manny and there's going to be some disaster at some point. You get a good ride for a certain period, so but there's going to be some disaster. And then I want to talk about what I think the key issues in adjusting to globalization so that it benefits all of us. Risk. The problem that I think gets incredibly neglected, and it plays a significant part in our banking issue, was the loss of local information. When you go to global finance, the guys at the global level can't go to my house when they've given me a mortgage, and come and see that I'm letting the house run down, and you know bad things are happening, and get suspicious. They can't do that. And if my mortgage is owned by people in Norway or people in Los Angeles, the local bank is totally out of the loop, and this information is lost there. I want to talk about offshoring immigration, and then offer two radical propositions, which I've been moved to by events and maybe overly moved. Okay, so I think the general thing is just there is a real race between pressures for convergence of wages and technical change that's going to shift out the production thing, and the price falls from buying these goods. So there's people racing. We had the view that the globalization and there's this, meant this large increase of unskilled labor. And it clearly has done that. I said it's roughly doubled the workforce. And that clearly places some downward pressure on people's wages. We didn't know or we didn't recognize the importance of this mass higher education. And I call this human capital leapfrogging. It's very conscious in China. It's less conscious decision in India and some of the other countries, but this huge spread of knowledge in the developing countries has reduced our comparative advantage. And it means that people in competition, it's not unskilled labor is the only place that we have some competition. It's across the boards. And I said the transition could be a while. So this is the old story. This is us wearing the hats, graduating. I don't know when UCLA is graduating, but I know that Harvard's not going to graduate in a couple of weeks, so on. And then we had the poor guys in the developing countries there sitting there making our stuff. That was what we were told at the time of the NAFTA treaty, that we didn't have this competition. I want to now give you some facts about these things. In 2006, the latest year I can get data, 142 million people around the world enrolled in college. That's the UN definition of tertiary things, and you know, okay. That's a fourfold increase over 1970. Our industry, the higher education industry, has been one of the great growth industries around the world. We are, you know, far more important than automobiles. And they should be probably giving more bailout money to us. They are, actually. They're giving it for R&D, so, but they're not giving it for actually education, which makes it some problem. 40% of these people are in the new globalizers, which is China, India, and the ex-Soviet. It's really China and India. The ex-Soviet are less important. 72% of these people are in LDCs. So the typical university graduate will be from a less developed country, and that was not true. The U.S. in 1970 had 29% of university graduate original enrollment. Sorry, I have the figures for graduates as well. So I go back and forth sometimes in using them. We're now down to 12%, and that was as of 2006. My guess is by 2009, this year, we'll be down to maybe 10%, and our share just dropping. We've sort of stabilized, more or less, our graduates and other guys. So I gave some figures for China on the Bachelor of Science Engineers, compared those to the Americans, where there's an issue. One of my friends at Duke has pointed out a lot of these comparisons were vaguely bogus because the guys doing the comparisons were adding in two-year Chinese graduates and not adding in U.S. computer scientists, whereas the Chinese definitions include both. You know, it's still 4-1, so it's not 8-1 or something, whatever the other numbers were. Then for PhDs, we were nearly 50% in 1975. And I put the nearly because it's very hard to get good statistics for the Soviets, and someone here may have better data than I was able to come up with. And so that's a little complicated, but you know, we're down. And I said about 15% 2010. That would be pretty accurate. The big riser in world PhD production is China, and these are not Chinese PhDs in the U.S., you know, or the Western world. This is Chinese PhDs in China. And since most of the Chinese PhDs in the U.S. tend to stay for a pretty long period of time, I mean, they're semi-permanent in our setting, I would count them with our PhDs rather than with China's for comparative advantage reasons. And then we have fallen from second in university grads divided by age group. The first was Canada in 1992. This is over a very short period of time. We're now 14th in the world. And that's 2005. There's probably some more recent OECD figures I haven't updated. So you've got to think about our great comparative advantage with the skilled, and we have lost some of that to other countries in a substantial way. So this is just saying, look, what we've seen in the LDCs shows up in industrial decisions, multinational research and development centers built in China, has been offshoring to India, IBM has made all of its recent huge investments in India, and this means just more job competition for our graduates. The global sourcing. There's not a major company I know that doesn't talk about global sourcing. The notion that you would just be, if you're, quote, an American company, big multinational, you're not going to be sourcing only in the U.S. You're offshoring immigration. And we have a lot of university competition via international students. I suggested to Harvard, the admissions committee, that just as a little experiment, why don't we only admit this year Chinese students? And then I said, well, we do know, we're not sure of the quality of the students from mainland China. Why don't we just admit Chinese, this is not Chinese American, this is Chinese national students who got U.S. bachelor's degrees. And we could fill our class with a reasonably, you know, good bunch of people. We didn't do that. But we could. And I just think eventually this is going to show up as many more of these people go back home to their home countries. The U.S. share of top universities, which is extraordinary in all the different rankings. That's going to fall a bit too. Maybe it'll fall fast. I don't know. Okay. So with this process of, it does mean that there's more competition across the boards for us. But at the same point, we all have this huge increase in the number of people who can contribute to knowledge and do stuff like this. Now, that serves my first point. I'm still positive because I think that expansion of higher education is more competition for us, but it's also the good. Now, what about some of these dangers and risks? I took away from this Wall Street implosion one of the things globalization has done. It does mean that the swine flu can come very quickly to the U.S. It can mean SARS can come very quickly to Toronto. It clearly means there's a danger of global pandemics and so on. And the world is kind of reasonably well organized to deal with that. I mean, we're not sure how well organized, but that seems to be the WHO. We put resources there, and the China's really done improved a lot their ability to report things. And if you look at what we did to the recent thing, it looks like we had something. But now, and I said, well, guys, you know, terrorism, I don't know very much thing, but does seem the world maybe has done a reasonable job of that. Political insanity, I don't know. But it's the financial disaster is the one that we took, obviously they weren't paying attention to or something. And then I think it is true, and we should take very seriously the notion that what the markets do is they give us some reasonably good growth for certain periods, and then there's this rare short intervals of disaster. And I was very impressed with a little graph that Nassim Taleb, the author of the Black Swan, put together. He showed some bank, and it's, I don't know, 30, 40 years of the bank's profits, and it's growing up. And then, like, in the 1 week in the last year, the value of the bank goes to zero, meaning everything, it's just a disaster of a sort. And we know this is the scary thing about global warming is, there's some people saying there's a possibility within 50 years there'll be a huge disaster from that. And then the pandemic, everybody, the fear is that there's going to be, something like the 1912, the World War II times, World War I time period. And you need some insurance against this. I thought naively that the whole business of the risk sharing through the Wall Street, all these smart instruments, that the risk was being shared, we were getting insurance, and we learned that was not the case. And we need some resources to deal with this stuff. So I just come back to this. Ultimately, it does mean that if we're going to deal with the positive aspects of globalization and minimize the pandemics and all the other things, we need international organizations, and that's pretty scary if you think about it. So I said, well, if it's going to be the UN and these international organizations, oh my lord, that's pretty scary kind of thing. But obviously, if you're going to have a global economy and a global, pandemics and the health sector, you have to have global forces. You have to have global something. I mean, not just the government, but some way to deal with it. And then I thought about, oh my lord, that's pretty scary. So I show you a UN conference, some talking heads, maybe Ed and I who were there today, and then the Davos meeting. I think 2 years ago, the chairman of a bank that crashed completely guaranteed that he was in complete control of all the financial risks of the world. This is the head of Lehman Brothers. And so you just sort of sit there and say, well, we do need Lucy and the doctor. And then I still come back. What do we have? Now, the globe there, is meant to be a brain. The closest I could get to the whole world, you know, the two sides of the brain or something. That's the world. It's all the brains we got. The guy to the right is a robot. You may know him as your governor, but he's meant to, here he is representing robot power, and meaning computer power. And in the middle, for those of you who are not science fiction aficionados, is the singularity. And, you know, there is this view, not just among science fiction folks, but that you take the computer power, you take all this R&D money that the president now is pouring money into R&D, which is going to benefit our industry a lot. You take the internet, and just all this people and talented people around the world, and you combine it, and you're just going to see knowledge go zooming through the wall, and we're just going to, if we apply it correctly, we have great opportunity for huge advances if we don't screw up. And so that's the singularity, this rapid growth of stuff. I want to give a couple of examples of this. The one came today, this morning. So I'm reading the newspaper in the guest house, thanks to the internet, and I'm saying, oh, I'll add that example to my talk. So I didn't realize this, and maybe there'll be some critical comments about it. Maybe it's not exactly true, but it represents. This is China suddenly doing coal-powered plants, the biggest builder of clean coal power, and they said mastering the technology and driving down coal. Well, okay, we may be slow on this one because, I don't know, the Robert Byrd is still there and defending the coal industry and so on and so forth. And assume the story is true. You know, it may not be exactly true for the New York Times, but they're basically right. But they said, well, we're still debating this. The Chinese are doing it. Now, the minute that succeeds and goes over and this kind of thing, that's going to press us and other countries to go more. That's the positive thing of globalization, and it's done in China. The other example I know much better, and I still have the correct word, okay, Circus. You may not hear of Circus, maybe you have. I said everybody here may have heard something about this. As you drink your red wine, you think you can live forever because of this thing called resveratrol. Well, last week at our seminar we have a seminar on the economics and business of science. Mr. Sinclair came and spoke to us, and he said you have to drink a lot of wine to get the benefits. But once they figured out it was resveratrol, they then found out that worked through the sirtuin. I should say enzymes. I'm sorry. Enzymes. Sorry, invented a new molecular entity, as they call it. And I'm carrying the Paul for Leon. So there's this company. What it struck me when he gave his talk, aside from some of the science things, is that what they're doing. What they're doing is they're getting things that are 400 times more powerful than the resveratrol, and they're going to be testing it out and. Boom. It works on at least rats and fish and yeast to an extraordinary extent. So it's just, okay, he's an Australian. He was working in Australia and he's been looking for a postdoc. Some professor from MIT, whose nationality I haven't checked out, came, spoke to Australia, they hit it off, and he decided he was going to go to MIT to do his postdoc. It appears Harvard Medical School hires him. He's worked with some U.S. scientists at Harvard and He connects up with a guy I couldn't figure out his nationality, and it wasn't clear on the web, but he was brought up in the U.S. from at least the age 3 or something. He may be German, or he may be U.S. I'm not quite sure. I mean, he's U.S. citizen now, sure. But exactly how you would classify him. They formed this company, Citrus, in order to make these compounds. In order to speed up the process, because to find compounds that will make this better, the things they go and outsource a lot of the work to Chinese chemists, because it's one-third the cost of doing it in the U.S. They still have some Cambridge chemists working on it, and et cetera. The company has now been bought. One of the most remarkable sort of either great operations by GlaxoSmithKline, which I think is a U.K. firm, but I wasn't quite sure. because you know, Blackstone Welcome is UK. I don't know how you call these firms at this point, but a big giant multinational. They, on their website, they list their things in pounds, so I think UK probably is a correct assessment. Incredible internationalization of the whole operation. Just a footnote, that the little firm was sold for $700 million without ever having done a human test yet, because they think this is golden for the future. And I said, there's Ponce de Leon. Well, I suppose he was Spanish when he was searching for the Fountain of Youth. But this is about as close as you get as we seem to be to the Fountain of Youth. And you know, I haven't got a good counter, you know, example to say this couldn't have happened without globalization. Mr. Sinclair says he never could have done anything, you know, if it wasn't that he came to the great city of Boston and our universities. But if he'd come to UCLA or Berkeley or Stanford or a bunch of other things, you know, the same kind of stuff presumably would have happened. And maybe he'd gone to another country. He denies that, you know, his immigrant sometimes are totally committed to the place. But certainly globalization was extraordinary in this. So I'm now to some of the policy issues to that. I just want to make clear that singular goal, that the good thing of that is not it's not hypothetical. You can give other examples, I think, as well. We're going to have a lot of offshoring and immigration, and my prejudice is for the immigration. I think we have a big policy choice, and there's a lot of jobs we can offshore. See that chemical offshoring that they did in that company. There's a debate in economics, and I don't know. I don't know who's right, to be in a conceptual sense or not. I couldn't give evidence to prove. Some of our colleagues from Princeton University have said that the way to think of offshoring is simply a new technical change. So offshoring is like the equivalent of creating a robot in your workplace that'll create, you know, do things more efficiently, or a new machine. It's a technical advance. Now it's just that some guys in third world countries are doing the work instead of the robot and the machine, and therefore all of our workers are going to benefit from this. And that seems pretty peculiar when you start thinking of, well, they're offering my job. And so it has a odd flavor. There's a recent paper which says, well, we in the advanced countries, as I interpret the paper at least, says, are you having good labor rents because we still have some great things, advantages beyond, you know, school learning and so on. And that's sort of the kind of stuff that Sinclair certainly spoke about our seminar. And then offsourcing ultimately dissipates them and workers lose. And I think the key missing element in both of these sets of models is this localized learning spillovers that this country, some of the other advanced countries, you create a great culture where the industry and the learning and the university are tied together, and somehow or other it works. Eventually they're going to catch up. And eventually we want them to catch up, because then who knows what more great things they'll create. But we want them to catch up, you know, when they're sort of closer to us in living standards, so that we don't have any less downward pressure. That's a big issue. And then there's the second issue of how do we maintain some comparative advantage in good jobs in this global world. And I, you know, assuming we've controlled the monsters, the apocalypse guys, I think we need smart infrastructure and R&D investment. We were not doing that under the Bush administration. They didn't. When they had a bill, the American Competes bill, that might have done some of that, they were not willing to tax anybody in the country to do it, except they were going to cut some things on poor people. That was their tax policy. It didn't pass. And now we have a great experiment. $21.5 billion going to R&D, $50 billion going into a lot of green infrastructure stuff. We will see. Multinationals are very interesting in this process. I say they do the Lord's economist, I believe, in the invisible hand, work in the LDCs. They're spreading knowledge and they're creating good jobs for these poor guys. But they are undermining labor in advanced countries. It almost goes to the same thing. And they do a great job in lobbying the government for R&D and education money. So I have very mixed, you know, how you feel about that. And then is a good example of what's happened in the spread of this knowledge. There are four the four big players investing in nano. Nanotechnology was an investment thing that basically the Clinton administration pushed. And the Bush guys sort of followed through on it, whereas the Bush guys really cut back the NIH spending in real terms quite a bit. They didn't really follow through on that. The U.S., EU, Japan, China is the fourth. Russia has announced last year, I think it was last year, that they are going to now put several billion dollars into nanotech. So there'll be a fifth. There'll be a fifth player in this process. And the China is the odd one because China just didn't think that China had built up enough capability to do that. Okay. There's another race, and you said the rest of the countries. I'm just going to talk a little bit about that. The reason I put these particular races is my favorite racer is in the race. And she ended up winning a gold medal. Maybe not, I don't know, this race or some other race, but I got a picture of her in this race. And she did win a gold medal. These guys, these other countries, they had big problems too. I said overcoming inequality. China's terrified of inequality creating social instability. The informal sector's grown in a lot of these countries. They had health problems, pollution problems, terrorism, and then financial disaster exported from the U.S. To our surprise. I can say, well, we need some new policies here. I'll say not too much about them, except I think it's important, the last one, this country realized that the Wall Street brand of crony capitalism is bad for our health. And the administration's gone back and forth on that. Occasionally they seem to recognize it, and then other times, but I think Tim Geithner and Larry Summers remember that they treat Wall Street well. That's their friends, and they will be richly rewarded when they leave office. And then I get very upset whenever I hear comments that we've got to pay the bankers the best, they have to be the best and brightest. Let me just say one thing that I'm not sure it's true, but if it is true, we'll break in the news. And it's, one of my Harvard students came up to me. I teach a course that has a lot of future quants in it. And he said, I've just been offered $40,000 by one of the banks not to take a job. I said, what? And he said, yeah, not to take a job. I said, wow. And they said, well, that's pretty amazing. I said, well, they offered me $40,000 not to take a job. He says, no. You teach the stuff, but you don't know how to really do it. And I said, okay. And then I said, is it taxpayer dollars that they're paying you? And he said, no, he was getting it from some Swiss bank. Then I talked to another one of my students, and she said, well, it's gone up to $50,000, because there's a little competition there among the banks for who is going to pay you not to take their job. What they're doing is they're apparently going to the students that they had recruited and had been paying large sums for summer things, saying, we don't have any jobs for you now, but we want you to be around when we want you, and here's a little gift. And so I'm having a student now exploring whether or not the banks that took our taxpayer money are doing this. And if they are, I promise you we will make a scandal out of that. Because $40,000 or $50,000 is about what an average American worker makes for working. And it just blew my mind. And I thought that was crony capitalism at the end. That you're paying people, and that's not what we want these best and brightest kids to do. I want them to get a job in the Securities Exchange Commission or the FBI, going after these kind of characters, not doing this. And I put it here very sharply. And we want them to do more than redistribute rents. Because I think what we've now seen from the whole Wall Street operation was that is a redistribution of rents. They redistribute. And then the rents disappeared. It turns out it was even worse. That the banks that made all that money paid huge bonuses and things to the bankers. Then it turns out to have zero value, and there's no value left to the bank, and the shareholders, and the pension funds, everybody else lost. Okay. We're almost done with this. Well, I have two scenarios. You know, one's a good one, one's a bad one, for the way this will all end. And obviously, we want to have the good scenario. TC is technical change. I sort of said all these things. And then I want to offer you my radical propositions. So I'm looking on the web to what I see in radical. And for the better or worse, you don't see left-wing guys waving, Marxian banners. This is some sort of scientific radical. I don't know anybody here. I don't know quite what it is. But it's something. It was very pretty color, so I put it out. So the two radical propositions. I think, and I've used the word equitable in quotes, that equitable income distribution may be critical to having a stable economy. I never would have thought that until now. And I thought it didn't matter if rich people buy luxuries and middle-class poor people buy necessities. It doesn't matter. Just as long as the money is being spent, we have demand. It seemed to be a reasonable economics view. Conservative guys always said more money to the rich because they needed incentives. The rich people I know, they may be crooked, some of them, but they certainly aren't lazy and need money to incentivize them. But that the view was incentives for the people at the top, or else they're going to, I don't know what. I think my new view is, yeah, you've got to give more incentives to people in the middle, but in fact you need an equitable distribution. And I think the big surprise to me in this, it shouldn't be a surprise, but I claim I never thought about it. I think it was my terrain. So that inequality of the kind we've had in our country gives massive incentives to cheating, financial fraud, crime, speculation, and looting at the top. Looting is a technical term in economics that basically refers to what you do is you run up the profits of your company in the short term while killing off it in the long term, and your bonuses are attached to the short term. And you make decisions like that. And this has huge impacts. Turns out there's a growing literature. It's amazing the way economics can shift. When I was first concerned with executive comp, and I gave a couple of classes in my labor economics course on this, so I read the literature, and I just said, this is what guys are showing, blah, 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 blah. It was all about the great virtues of these stock options and so on, how you got the incentives along. Now the literature in this area is all about cheating. And it's about how companies that give stock options make riskier decisions, make more financial misreporting. Now, nobody yet has said and crashed the firm the way Enron did. But I'm sure that there'll be a paper that'll come along and that will say the bigger the stock options were, the bigger the chance the firm crashed. Because if you're taking, you're misreporting and you're doing all this, et cetera. And then I think it leads to the capture of regulatory agencies in the government. And that means they protect themselves, et cetera. So I think that's my proposition. I'm not claiming it as as empirical evidence is strong. But the more I'm seeing, there's a lot of people who are looking in a similar way. And the second of all is, how do you control the crony capitalism if you believe it's destructive to us? This is the weaker, I would say, proposition. And the reason I say need greater an NGO countervailing power. Somewhere we got to stop this. And my view is this. This is my most radical view, and I think we can build some models of this. We'll make it less radical, but at least we'll give it some mathematical structure. See, most of our economics, our basic model, Arad Zubruah kinds of models, don't have in them anything that is like a network. If you build in a network of people, you then build in the structure that can be crony capitalism, and they enrich themselves at the expense of the other people. We've always known there's a Pareto tale of the wealthy. And we've always known that can't be generated easily. It can't be generated by any law, normal, or just random shocks. Something going on with that upper tail that's peculiar. There are different models of that. Well, one model would be some people get up there and they spend a lot of resources taking care of themselves in some fashion. And that is my current radical view of this. And they regulatory capture, the notion of regulatory capture is not a left-wing view. It's associated with George Stigler and right-wing Chicago guys who would say that's what you expect. And yeah, that's part of this whole process. I think the globalization gives us one opportunity to fight this. Because crony capitalism has always been very localized. And and there's a fair chance you can amass global forces, I think, against it. but we'll see. The reason I said this as needs rather than make a claim is I know that labor is involved with trade unions, and they are not the most dynamic, forward-looking organization around. And NGOs, you know, some of them are, some of them aren't. I'm not quite sure, but something's got to be there to stop the crony capitalism. So I say, can we the people control? And you see, I have great faith in our president. After all, she did this. She did win World War II for us. Some reason to do this. But then I do worry that that's the hand of Wall Street stretching up. I would have liked if I was good enough to have a $40,000 check in there for bright young students to see if they can guarantee you'll be around when we need you, et cetera. But I'm reasonably optimistic that, in fact, this Wall Street thing has given us a great opportunity to deal with all of the problems of globalization. Oh, I shouldn't have done this. I'm done. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Richard.